Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we continue our series of conversations with the candidates vying for their party's nomination in Oklahoma's 1st Congressional District. The runoff is coming up on both the Republican and Democratic side on August 28th. Last week on Studio Tulsa, we spoke with Democratic candidates Tim Gilpin and Amanda Douglas. Their conversations are available at our website, publicradiotulsa.org, if you missed the conversation. Today, my guest is Republican candidate Tim Harris. Now, we've also reached out to his primary challenger, Kevin Hearn. But after repeated attempts to contact the campaign, we've been unable to schedule an interview with the candidate. Tim Harris finished first in the Republican primary with just under 27.5% of the vote. He's a graduate of Oral Roberts University Law School, and he joined the Tulsa County District Attorney's Office right out of law school, and in his 14 years there moved up to first assistant. In 1998, he was elected district attorney and spent 16 years as the county's top law enforcement official. Today, he's a professor at Oklahoma Wesleyan University and Oral Roberts University. And he joins me to discuss his reasons for running and his priorities if elected. Mr. Harris, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here, and I relish the opportunity to present myself to your listeners.
All right. Well, tell us what made you decide to run for Congress.
It's a servant's heart. I served in the DA's office for 16 years as the elected and 12 years as an assistant before that. When I left the office in December of 14, I kind of felt that there was another chapter in my life. Wasn't exactly sure what that was. Went back to Oral Roberts University as an adjunct professor and taught pre-law for five semesters. Also went to Oklahoma Wesleyan University and taught in the MBA program a great course called the American Framework for Free Enterprise. And it was very, very much eye-opening. I would have to say the final catalyst was the chairman of our department convinced me and twisted my arm and put me in a full Nelson and said, hey, would you teach constitutional law? And I said, well, hey, you know, it's been 34 years since I studied constitutional law. And so when I saw how far afield we've come from our balance of power and how it's supposed to work, it was really the catalyst in my heart that said, hey, I love this country. I love the American dream. I want to be able to secure that, you know, for posterity, which is referred to in the preamble to the Constitution. We all realize as we get older, there's going to be a baton that we pass to a generation that comes behind us. If it's called America, I wanted to recognize what it was and try and fight for the same liberties and freedoms that allowed me to grow up free and to go to a law school and to practice law and to get married and raise my family and have two kids and watch them grow up in a free America. That was really the catalyst that got me to run in this. And then once I decided, I mean, in June of 2017, the five Republican candidates came to a forum and I was the first one to speak. And I said, you know, I pledge that I would run a positive campaign. In my heart of hearts, in the position I'm taking now and will always take, the election should be won based on a candidate's merits and the best ideas presented in the marketplace as to how to serve the people.
You mentioned the balance of power.
Yes.
Do you feel like the balance of power has moved too far to the presidency, to the judiciary? Certainly not to the Congress, because most observers have said Congress has become far weaker in the balance of power.
You know, I've seen that pendulum swing, and every time Congress doesn't do what they're supposed to do, there becomes a power void. And I think that that power void usually gets filled by the executive.
Or the judicial sometimes.
Well, yeah. And right now, I think Congress has to have some courage. Let's address some of these issues that they're supposed to be addressing instead of kicking the can down the road. We kick difficult issues, what I call the hot potato issues like immigration, right? The Congress doesn't have the political courage to make a decision, and they have to. That's their job. Because when we don't, then we live by executive mandate, right? And we see whether a president's there for 4 or 8 years, we have all these executive mandates and opinions that come out and get signed, and they have the force of law. And then what happens at the end of 8 years, if we have a flipping party and there's a new presidency and a new president there, they spend most of their time retracting the old executive orders. There is no major company in the world that only has an 8-year vision to the future, right? It's no way to run a country. So I think we have to get back more to that balance of power. We have to take on really difficult issues. And, you know, from my standpoint of view, I think what differentiates me from my opponent is my passion for people, right? I'm a public servant. I'm not a politician. People know who I am. I've been accountable and answerable to the people of Tulsa County, 650,000 people. I've got a 16-year record that they can depend on and that I'm proud of. Trusted, steady, reliable. That may not be flashy, but I think that's what people want, because I want to tell you one thing. We have now been campaigning 14 months and a couple of weeks. This whole campaign can be boiled down to one word: trust. People don't feel like they can trust their elected officials anymore. That's why I think they can trust me. They know me. You know, how does a leader lead? In my opinion, first and foremost, one of the skills that I learned, and of course my wife would probably contend with this, is listening, right? You have to listen to people to figure out what it is the pressure points are that they're suffering and what they want their elected representatives to do for them. You know, leading with a servant's heart, that's where you get the phrase servant leadership. You know, you teach people how to lead by showing them how to serve. That's what I've done for my career, and that's what I want to take to Washington. You know, one of the skills that I gained as the district attorney is negotiation skills. We need people who know how to negotiate. You know, if you come into this battle, whether you're a Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're independent, if you come to the table with your list of 10 things and you say, by gosh, we're going to get all 10 or I'm walking away, you know what? You will never get all 10, okay? True negotiation has to be a give and take. And so really, if you walk away with 7 out of 10, you probably hit a home run. And so you have to give a little bit to get a little bit. And I'm not talking about ever walking away from your principles. But most of the issues are what I call in the preference bucket. They're not principles that you're stuck on and are your heartfelt foundation and you're not going to walk away from them. They are those areas that need to be negotiated, and you're probably not going to get everything you want. And if the other side comes to the negotiation table, they're probably not going to get everything they want. Really, what that will be is what I call good public policy for the people.
May I ask you?
Yeah.
When you look at Congress, and I would say, both sides have this issue. A lot of times it's about no compromise. And through no compromise, you serve the base, you keep getting elected. I mean, leadership of both parties at times do not want to compromise. You're going to come in, and what if the leadership says, no, we're not going to compromise? What are you going to do?
You know, it's funny. I'm a Republican. I'm probably a true conservative. I think less government is better. I'm a free trader. I want the marketplace to solve our issues. I believe in personal moral responsibility for individuals. But, you know, when you go there, you take an oath to the Constitution of the United States to support, obey, and defend the Constitution. You don't take an oath to support, obey, and defend the Republican platform or Republican leadership or Democrat platform or Democrat leadership. That's what I think probably will distinguish me. I will be willing to work with all sides. You know, if the Democrats come up with good policy, I think you have to have the strength to reach across the aisle and say, you know what? I wish I would have thought of that. That is really good. And if it's good for the people of the first district, I'll support it regardless of who comes up with it. And by the same token, I think what happens is coming in as a negotiator who's reasonable and, like I said earlier, a listener, I think you build that credibility with people. And we both know life is about relationships, right? Yes. Same in Congress, right? You have to get there. People have to learn who you are. You know, I will go as a citizen legislator, like the framers of the Constitution devised. What that means is you go for a finite period of time. Don't really know exactly how long that is. But first and foremost, you have a 2-year term limit because you have to get reelected every year, okay, every 2 years. And so, you know, people say, well, what are your thoughts on term limits? I can take a cue from the people of Oklahoma who have set 12-year term limits on our state senators and our elected officials and our state representatives. So I'm not going to serve longer than 12 years, okay? I can guarantee you that. Why? I think Oklahomans have spoken, and that's a good cue. If I can't get done in 12 years what I want to get done, then shame on me, right? I don't think you should go there and make decisions to feather your nest just to get reelected the next cycle. Now, with that being said, 2-year cycles, I mean, let's face it, you're always running. You have to, okay, because 2 years is a very short period of time.
And you're raising money.
But your mindset has to be, I'm here to serve the people and make decisions that serve them, not make decisions that will get me reelected. Can't be bought by special interest, right? I've been tried to be bought off many times as district attorney. I can't be bought, and I won't be bought. And so, therefore, I have the flexibility to be actually represent the people of the first district, make decisions that support them, and however long my tenure there is, then so be it.
My guest today is Tim Harris, a former district attorney and Republican candidate for Congress. The Republican runoff is coming up August 28th, and we're talking with the first district runoffees here on Studio Tulsa. Well, you kind of gave us sort of your philosophy. But what's the biggest thing you want to accomplish as a congressman if you're elected?
I think it's creating a culture in which we can treat everybody with respect and dignity. Let's get back to what I was raised on a college campus in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin, which was, you know, college campuses need to be a place where debate and ideas can be argued and debated back and forth without violence, okay, without name-calling, without personalities getting in the way of the idea being presented. So hopefully I can bring a culture of change to Washington in which this vitriol kind of talk about one another and the name calling. I mean, you know, if you spit in a man's face, it's really difficult to get him to the negotiation table and have him treat you with any respect and vice versa. I won't ever do that. Okay, now I've got positions and I will debate them. What differentiates us from the rest of the world is our rule of law and our ability to have freedom of speech. Well, you know, we're losing that. This whole Antifa movement that has erupted on some college campuses, it's kind of like, oh my gosh, what has happened? This is the very place that we need to have the free flow of ideas and let the ideas in the marketplace win the day. And, you know, with that being said, this election cycle isn't as much about me as it is about you and your listeners and your grandchildren and future grandchildren so that they have the ability to live the American dream. I mean, Justice Scalia, before he died, he said the cornerstone of democracy is the rule of law. The rule of law gets applied equally to all of us, the rule makers and the rule followers of people. That's what differentiates us, makes us the envy of the rest of the world, and yet we're losing some of that. And so for some of those basic constitutional rights, our right of free speech, our right to practice our religion in the marketplace without the government telling us how to do that, our Second Amendment rights, that we have some core rights that I will be fighting for, and yet I will do it with respect and dignity to everyone I listen to, because I came from a career where I was a decision maker. Every day I had to make decisions about people, the people who lived in Tulsa County, and their freedom and their public safety. And so I have the foundation to go to Washington to make decisions in behalf of the constituents from a good policy standpoint of view. And since I've applied constitutional policy for my whole career, it's a hand in glove for me to now be in a position to actually help formulate policy because, you know, you only got three decisions. Either it's a good law or it's a good law, but it hasn't been implemented very well and it needs to be amended, or it's a bad law. If it's a bad law, then have the courage to repeal it. If it's a good law, but somehow in implementation it just isn't getting done what you wanted to get done, then keep working on the implementation. And then if it's a good law and it's working, then stand by it, but apply it so that the rule of law keeps us free.
Let me ask you, you talked about changing the culture of Washington, yes. Changing the culture of Congress. The president of the United States right now is very prone to name-calling, as you refer to it, right, with 3 a.m. tweets, right, of referring to his political opponents in the most denigrating ways. How do you change the culture of Washington when, you know, the leader of the nation, President of the United States, is sort of spearheading that you know, philosophy.
Certainly, he's very, very powerful, as is his cabinet. But, you know, if I'm going there as a change agent, I'm part of his party, maybe I can have an effect as much on the presidency as anybody, where I'm supporting policies that I think serve the people, but doing it in a way. I studied under Chuck Colson. I'm a Colson fellow. And, you know, he talks about the Imago Dei. And, if you believe in the Bible, which I do, Genesis 1:27 says, hey, we were all made in the image of God. If that's true, it really changed my look that when I get in a debate with somebody, they are the image of God. And, you know, when you approach a situation like that, it kind of puts you back in your place a little bit. And the way you treat that person changes. It just changes. It gives them a level of respect and dignity that I think they deserve. And so, you know, I won't be flowing in that kind of vitriol where we call names about our opponents. Now, you know, people's records and their stances on issues, I think, are open for debate. But how you do that without demeaning the human being has to be done. So, you know, I will be going there with this kind of an idea. You know, one thing I learned as district attorney, I represented Democrats, I represented Republicans, I represented independents, men, women, children, whatever their preferences are, I had to represent them. And so I know what it means to be a statesman, and I will take that to Washington with me to serve all the people.
Let me ask you about some big issues that you're likely to confront as a congressman. Yeah. Immigration bill has been stuck in the House forever. There has been at least one immigration bill that passed the Senate several sessions ago, but there seems to be no solution that can get support of the majority of the House. What is your thought on immigration? You have several competing issues. You have the DACA, the Dreamers. Okay. Are you in support of giving them continued status in the United States?
Yes.
Is it continued status or a path to citizenship?
Whatever they want. You know, those Dreamers that have served in the military, I think, should have an automatic pass to citizenship. They took an oath to put their life on the line to protect me, my family, and my freedom. I think they get a green light straight to citizenship. I think for those Dreamers that want to become citizens, they don't leapfrog in front of everybody else that is in the queue, so to speak. They kind of go to the end of the line and they take their turn as they apply. And for those that don't want to become citizens, if they're employed here, then we have to figure out some kind of an employment situation, visa, something that would allow them to continue to stay here and work. Let's face it, these kids came here without a decision on their own. They grew up here. If you talk about trying to deport them back to their country of origin, they may not even speak the language of the country of origin. They may not even know what family ties they have in their country of origin. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me to just, you know, broad brush, you know, let's deport them all. So, you know, that's my thought on the Dreamers. But on the immigration issue, I really do believe that this is something that Congress has to take on. You're right. It's that hot potato issue. And if you come down on an opinion, you know, maybe you lose some votes. And so this will be very telltale about both Democrats and Republicans about how they come down on this issue. But it has to be solved. We can't just do this continue piecemeal. And so, you know, we have ideologies out there that are very much dissimilar of the United States. I mean, Iran has said, hey, death to America, and they're burning American flags. I mean, they do not appreciate our values and our principles. We cannot have that kind of mindset infiltrate this country and bring us down internally. Therefore, we need to know who's coming into this country. We know that our southern border is a sieve right now that has to be shored up. Now, you know, whether we need a bricks and mortar wall or we need this metal wall, you know, from the Pacific Ocean all the way over to the east, I don't know about that. It did work in El Paso. I mean, in El Paso, across from Juarez, when they put the wall up, the crime rate dropped 25% in 1 year. Okay, so when you're looking at some of these ideas, I think some of them work. Whether it's increased border control, or whether it's fencing, or whether it's drones and technology. I mean, for crying out loud, we have satellites up in the sky that can see a gnat on a fence post, for crying out loud.
Well, let me ask you.
Let's use technology for our safety.
Right now, the holdup is tying the construction of the wall to getting meaningful immigration reform. Mm-hmm. Is that something you feel like that has to be a trade-off?
Well, the president seems to think it is, right?
What about you, though?
I mean, he's saying, hey, we have to build the wall. I agree with him that we have to have security, but it could be a number of different measures. Again, to be able to negotiate that, I do not agree with chain migration. I think that, it gives a free pass through family bloodlines. So I don't agree that chain migration is there. I don't agree with the lottery system. I like what other industrialized countries have in the world with a merit-based system. Do you speak English? Do you want to speak English? Are you educated? What kind of skills do you bring to the table to make all boats rise in the United States? I think those are fair questions to ask, because I think when I was a child and my great-great-grandparents came over, they were Welsh and my mom was French and Bohemian. And when they immigrated here, they didn't leave their culture or their ethnicity behind, but they did come wanting to become Americans. They came here, they learned the language, they wanted to give back to the country that gave them their opportunities without giving up their cultural background and their ethnic traditions. That's what we got to get back to. I think we need to have people here who want to be here as citizens and who want to help give back to our tax structure, to everything that we believe in. That's what it means to be a country. And so a country without borders is no country at all. So we have to have borders. We look at some of the debacle that's happening in Europe right now with all the flood of immigrants coming to them without good policy of discerning how they let people in and deal with them when they get there. We can't just open up our borders. The American people have to decide who comes into this country and not people from outside our country. So with that being said, I think safety and security and immigration actually folds into national security, because we have to keep this country safe. I mean, one of the very things that is spoken about in the preamble and in Article 1, Section 8 is common defense. So it definitely is one of the enumerated responsibilities of the federal government. So national security and immigration are federal issues that have to be determined. And so the Congress has to step up to the plate. They've got to debate this out. They have to come up with a bill that they think can be passed and let that speak in behalf of the people.
Whoever the next congressman is likely to be, or congresswoman, they're going to face a situation in which we're very likely going to be in a serious trade war. The administration has put on tariffs on our near neighbors, Canada, Mexico, European Union, China, a wide variety of countries. And of course, there have been retaliatory tariffs put in place by those countries as well. Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, basically said Congress couldn't do anything about this. If they passed a bill, it would go to the president, it would be vetoed, discounting the idea of overriding that veto. What is your thought on Congress stepping in and repudiating these tariffs?
Short term, I think tariffs might accomplish something, but you have to look to the long term. If we are putting tariffs on our allies, then we alienate our allies. What we need to be doing is figuring out how to build a united front with our allies in economic trade to get China in tow, okay? China is not playing by any rules. They are stealing our intellectual property, and we have to get them in tow. That doesn't mean we're not going to continue to trade with them, but we have to create an atmosphere, in my opinion, where the allies all together working together, then China doesn't have a country that they can sidestep and go deal with and beat us at our own game. So, you know, short term, I think the president, he's so different from any other president that we've ever had. He knows how to shake the tree and start to begin to make things happen. But don't forget this. Tariffs is another word for tax. So if you continue to tax and you tax your neighbors, we tax the Canadians and the Mexicans and the Europeans and, you know, the Pacific Rim of Asia, our allies. Long term, I don't think tariffs are going to return to us what we want. I do think what it does is it helps everybody to look at trade agreements, go back to the negotiation table and try and achieve what is fair trade, free trade. They have to be as fair as we can possibly get there. So, you know, maybe short term, we're shaking the tree a little bit. I don't think long term tariffs will assist us and bolster the economy that we need to be bolstered. And so, you know, I support the president short term, but if he thinks that tariffs is a long term solution to our problems, I would have to disagree with him.
One last issue, healthcare. We've seen in the last year the number of uninsured go back up after the Affordable Care Act and some of the things that have happened over the last few years. I think the consensus view of the Republican Party is Obamacare doesn't work. But what can we do about getting down the number of healthcare? What's your ideas on healthcare?
You know, we've got some ideas. I mean, shame on the Republican Party. You know, we screamed repeal and replace, and then when we had the opportunity to do so, we didn't do it, okay? Personally, you know, I think that's really, really a mistake on our part. If your party is in power, meaning you have the presidency and you have the House and the Senate, by gosh, you ought to be getting some things done. If Obamacare isn't working and we see that premiums are going up and up and up and people are losing less freedom to decide between them and their doctor what their health care ought to be, then, you know, we have to create a system of what I call pools, right? Bigger pools of like cooperatives where people can join. That way they lower the premiums of the health care insurance policies that they buy. They are large enough to take care of people with pre-existing injuries. Also, we give employers a break when they subsidize health insurance for their employees. We ought to give the same tax break to individuals who have to buy their own insurance. And then I like health savings accounts. When I look at this, you know, when you're in your 20s and your 30s, you're pretty much bulletproof, or at least you think you are, you know, physically. Great. Let's allow some money to go into some health savings accounts. You can have higher deductibles in the very beginning, but you're probably not using your health insurance because you're healthy. Then, as you build up over time and you get older, you know, as we get older, these clay pots we live in begin to break down. Then when you begin to use your health insurance, you've got a nice pool of money there to draw from to help you with it. And then hopefully as you get older, the deductibles get lower. They can be higher on the front end when you're younger. And so I think there are some creative measures that will get us back to healthcare. My wife's a physician. She's a medical doctor. We talk about these kinds of things. How on earth did we ever get to a place where an insurance company determines what kind of a medical procedure you're going to have? That should be between a doctor and a patient, not an insurance company who's trying to get rich on the whole thing. We all know, oh, you have to call the insurance company and they either approve the procedure or the operation or whatever's going to happen, or they don't. Where did we ever get like that? That's insanity, in my opinion.
Well, we're out of time for our conversation today. We have time for just one last question of Tim Harris. Why should voters vote for you on August 28th?
Why? Because I will be your voice and a servant. I'm not going to Washington to be something. I've had a great career. I'm going there to do something. I won't go there trying to feather my nest and just get reelected. I will go there to fight for the people. I'm a fighter. I will protect your constitutional rights. And I'll close with this. It's not one guy or one gal that is going to change the world, but all of us working together in unity. There's so much disunity in our country and hatred and anger. We have got to begin to solve that. And I'll close with a quote by Ronald Reagan. He said, "While a constitution may set forth rights and liberties, only citizens can maintain and guarantee those freedoms. Active and informed citizenship is not just a right, it's a duty. It's us working together. I will be a listener. I will listen to my constituents that send me there, and no one will outwork me. I'm an empty nester now. I don't have kids at home. I can give the people of the First District 100% of my time to be working for them. I have the passion in my heart and the energy to do it, and I will be there for them, not for myself."
Tim Harris is a candidate for the Republican nomination for Oklahoma's 1st Congressional District. For more information on the candidate, visit VoteTimHarris.com. Now, we've also repeatedly reached out to his runoff opponent, Kevin Hearn, but have been unable to schedule an interview with the candidate. If you missed a portion of today's interview or our interviews with Amanda Douglas and Tim Gilpin, they're all available at our website, publicradiotulsa.org. The runoff election is August 28th, and the deadline to register to vote in the runoff is Friday, August 3rd. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.